Welcome to Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, a podcast brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. TIPQC exists to improve health outcomes for mothers and infants in Tennessee through our quality collaborative that will identify opportunities to optimize maternal and infant outcomes across our state and is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. The Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast is designed for medical professionals and for patients and families across the state. We will focus on all aspects of the perinatal period with special attention to reducing our maternal mortality rate. This podcast is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health.
Welcome to the Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast, brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. I am Scott Guthrie, a neonatologist, the state project leader for the Tennessee's Tiniest Babies Project, and the immediate past infant medical director for TIPQC. One of the things that I like so much about these podcasts are the interesting people we get to have conversations with about topics that can help improve care for mothers and babies, not only in Tennessee, but anywhere else where this podcast is being listened to. I'm really excited about today's podcast. Today's guest, depending on when you're listening to this, will be or was a speaker at TIPQC's annual conference in March of 2024. On today's show, we get to sit down and pick Dr. Jonathan Klein's brain and find out everything he knows about caring for really tiny babies and figure out what we can apply to the Tennessee's Tiniest Babies Project as we work on improving care for our tiniest citizens across the state. So Dr. Klein is currently a professor emeritus of pediatrics, as he's been at the University of Iowa since 1990. He was also the NICU medical director from 2005 up until just this past year. Dr. Klein and his colleagues have been in the forefront of caring for periviable infants for quite some time. For those of you not familiar with a periviable infant in that term, these are infants born before 24 weeks gestation. Dr. Klein and the Iowa team have a very specific approach to how they care for these infants, and we want to learn more about that today. Part of this involves high-frequency ventilation, which will be useful to learn about as we roll out the chronic lung disease reduction bundle across our state. Dr. Klein and his colleagues have published extensively in what they do, and we will include some links to these publications in our show notes so you can read more about their approach. Welcome to our show today, John. I hope you're okay with us going by first names. Do you want to say hi to our listeners real quick?
Yeah, I want to say hi to everyone in the great state of Tennessee, and that very excited to be able to have this conversation kind of about the Iowa approach to this unique population.
So I alluded to this earlier, but TIPQC is embarking upon a project to decrease the risk of chronic lung disease across all of our level 3 and level 4 NICUs. There's a recent Vermont-Oxford publication looked at the problems of prematurity, and the vast majority of those have actually decreased or remain stable, except for one, and that's chronic lung disease. Those rates have actually increased since 2012. So I have to wonder, part of the reason for this is because we're doing a better job of taking care of these tiny babies. We're, of course, at the highest risk for chronic lung disease. We're keeping them alive, but they are still developing chronic lung disease in the process. Now, John, this is why I really wanted to sit down with you and let everybody who's listening to this podcast today learn from you. Your team at Iowa are obviously some of the thought leaders in helping us figure out how to take care of these tiny babies. So I want us to take some time today and figure out what your recipe is and then see if we can apply some of this across the state of Tennessee. Now, first off, I've got a fun fact about you that I learned while we were doing our research for this podcast. One is that you actually come from a long line of neonatologists. And by that, I mean, neonatology is a new field. So you're like the second generation neonatologist in your family, which I thought was really cool. And then you've got your own NICU story yourself. Do you mind sharing that a little bit with our audience?
Yeah. So I'm glad to tell you a little bit about myself. So my father, who was kind of a World War II era veteran, he joined the military when he was 17 in order to get the GI Bill. And he went to the University of Pittsburgh. And at the University of Pittsburgh, he did his master's thesis in the lab of Jonas Salk on the isolation of the polio virus. And then because he had a recommendation from Jonas Salk, he got into med school at Johns Hopkins and went on from there. And his main interest was virology, but then he became very interested in neonatology and helped to start ventilating babies in the early to middle 60s, soon after Toronto was doing that and proceeding from there. And back then there was no HIPAA. So when I was 9 or 10 years old, and when he had to rush in emergently to the NICU, sometimes I would go in and I was allowed to watch. The most frequent procedure that was done back in the 60s was double volume exchange transfusion in all the term babies with RH hemolytic disease. And one of the most interesting things I remember is that my father, I'd be home and he'd get phone calls and he was having these very intense discussions and arguments with this guy named Billy Rubin. And it wasn't only until very recently that I realized Billy Rubin's a common name in New York, that it wasn't a guy. He was talking about hyperbilirubinemia and Billy Rubin. So it took me a long time to realize that. So it's just sort of naturally, I kind of was exposed to all this. And I did enjoy going in there and seeing all the intensity and all the use of technology, beginning in the middle 60s and then into 1970, where he was doing helicopter transports. And a lot of places weren't even caring for premature babies as early as the late 60s and early 70s. Yeah, many places didn't have the NICU. The NICU in Iowa, for example, was formed in 1975. And so I sort of genetically understood the importance, detail, and paying close attention to everything, and putting a lot of intensity into what you were doing and paying a lot of attention. Now, the other side thing that was interesting is, which I didn't realize, is that I don't have until very recently, related to colon cancer screening, is I have no ileocecal valve. My terminal ileum was removed a few weeks after birth. I was born with ileal duplication and I hadn't put everything together. And so it's just interesting that I have all this exposure to surgery. And back then, of course, babies didn't feel pain. So I'm very, sensitive to making sure that babies that are having surgical procedures undergo proper analgesia.
Wow. Love that story. And that's really cool how you've come from this, again, in perspective to how old neonatology is. It's in our world, a long line of neonatologists and your own experience. That's pretty neat. So, hey, I have been following what's been going on at Iowa, I guess, ever since I became a neonatologist about 20 years ago. And your tiny baby registry, I actually put a baby on that, I guess, 10, 15 years ago, a 370 grammar. So everything that y'all have done, I have read, I've been intrigued by, I've tried to improve my own care on how I care for these tiny babies. But tell our audience about what exactly you're doing there that makes this such important work. And then more importantly, I think hearing about your stats, just how you're doing with these 22, 23, 24 weekers, and then what their outcomes are.
Well, I mean, briefly, I will say, when I came to Iowa in 1990, the division director was Dr. Ed Bell, and he was very supportive of always pushing the envelope in the wall if that is what the family wished. We always put the family's wishes first. And I would certainly say there was a clear biological threshold in 1990, where if you were born before 24 weeks, and we had some that were precisely dated because they were IVF, that you could ventilate but not oxygenate. So CO2 could easily exchange, since it's 20 times more diffusible than oxygen. So you know you're at the threshold because you could ventilate, but you can never oxygenate. And those babies would soon pass away either from pulmonary hemorrhage or IVH or just severe hypoxic respiratory failure. You know, that started to change as we worked in conjunction with our obstetricians to focus more on using antenatal steroids. And based on all the great work that was done back in the 70s, there was plenty of evidence of the value of antenatal steroids in terms of accelerating lung development, as well as accelerating a lot of other issues, such as autoregulation of cerebral blood flow. So it's a neuroprotective strategy too. And we worked very hard with our OBs to say, hey, we know maximum impact is 48 hours. So we got them to start giving mothers at imminent risk of periviable delivery steroids at 23 5/7. Then parents started asking us, well, wait a minute, if I'm going to deliver before midnight, you won't resuscitate, but after midnight, you would resuscitate. And so we said, well, you're right. I don't think anything's that precise. So then it was parents that started asking us to start to intervene at 23 weeks. And that was sort of in the middle 90s. And we kept having outcomes that kept improving in terms of neurodevelopment outcomes and survival. And it basically, we had one or two babies in the early 2000s. And again, it was a parent saying, because we had switched from 23 and 5/7, 10 years later to 22 and 5/7. And the same thing, it was a parent who said, well, if I'm born before midnight, you're not going to resuscitate, but a minute later you will. And so those parents, if they wanted us to, we did resuscitate, and there was a few survivors. So in 2008, we formalized this approach with the use of antenatal steroids at 21 and 5/7 week, plus everything else. So I want people to understand this was all driven by parents. If the parent did not want any intervention, and we would just do palliative care and comfort care. But it was parents, and so our goal is always to support the parent. And many times there'll be parents asking for resuscitation, even though we know the mother has severe prolonged rupture of membranes, chorioamnionitis. The baby we know is not going to do well. But if the parent says, hey, if you try, feel better about that. And so we would try, and even though we know the baby wouldn't go past 24 hours potentially. Certainly there are other times where the parent, we know this baby probably would survive, but the parent says, you know, I just feel uncomfortable. Can I just do palliative care? I'm like, sure. And then they would say, well, what about the other? And they tell us the other twin, when that one comes out, if it gets past 23, I would be glad, I would like you to intervene. And so we always honor the parents' wishes. Now, I guess the question is, you sort of, you know, I wanted to concentrate a lot on what is done prenatally, because a lot of this practice has to start before birth. Now, the next question would be, as I'm giving my monologue here, is when you talk about resuscitation, our resuscitation has to begin, like I said, before birth. So there are certain things that we will institute in this population that we do now that we didn't do back then, but we're accelerating on. And we find things such as delayed cord clamping. A lot of good research has been done on that. And we found the same thing when we look back at our data. There was a strong association with reducing IVH with delayed cord clamping. Now, we're only able to do that in about 43% of babies under 22 weeks, because sometimes you have to initiate resuscitation sooner for it to really work. And so it wasn't always possible with all of them. This continues on just right from the, you know, we're still in the delivery room. Of course, everyone knows the importance of avoiding hypothermia. So that's pretty straightforward.
So I love hearing you talk about this approach to your OBs and getting your OB colleagues on board and working very well with them to make sure some of these antenatal strategies, the steroids, the magnesium, things like that are done in a timely manner, because we know these can help improve the outcomes of babies. But one of the things I hear from some of my friends around the state is sometimes getting their obstetrical colleagues to understand that we are actually able to resuscitate a 22-weeker and a 23-weeker. So let me get you to answer a couple things. One, what are the outcomes now at 22, 23 weeks? So our OB colleagues can understand what we're able to do. And then two, what do you say to get your OB colleagues on board with some of these changes that have taken place in our field over the past several years and how we've been able to drop the limits of viability?
So at 22 weeks gestation, if we look at our outcomes, and I use cumulative data from basically 2006 to 2022, the overall survival is 60%. We certainly have had years with survival a couple times as high as 79%, which is similar to some of the Japanese literature of 80%. And obviously we've had years with 25% survival. So I mean, you're dealing with small numbers, you can have a lot of variability, but overall, with very robust numbers, now at least 79 babies under 20 at 22 weeks, we feel very confident about 60% baseline survival. At 23 weeks, that jumps to 77%, and at 24 weeks, that jumps to 85%. So these are not, to me, if you're implying periviable, you're basically implying that survival is really not possible. It goes back to what it used to be prior to 2015 for the entire Vaughn network, which was 6 to 8%. currently, the entire Vine network's at 27%, and that includes centers that don't even offer resuscitation. When you start to look at centers that offer resuscitation, now talking about the average center having over 30% survival. So the other issue is there's this feeling that all these babies are neurologically devastated. And with the right approach, which is neuroprotecting, neuroprotection has to outweigh lung protection. So this is going to be a little bit of a new paradigm based on the quality project you're talking about. So brain protection, neuroprotection always outweighs lung protection, and they don't always travel in parallel. And that's an important issue. So our goal is to minimize things such as severe IVH or all IVH. So there's the implication that all 22 weekers have IVH and they all have severe IVH. And well, that's not true. For our population, all IVH is only around 38% of the 22-week population, and severe IVH is about 22%. So in that 22%, grade 3 and grade 4, we've only had 2% of 195 babies who needed a VP shunt. Now, these are all inborns. These are all inborns that we can control from beginning to end. So to minimize severe IVH, you have to not allow these babies to suffer severe hypoxic, hypocarbic events. And there's where there's going to be conflict with lung protection. Other things such as PVLs, a few percent, and ROP, we have a very aggressive practice on how to minimize the development of ROP and reduce the proliferation of ROP. So we've not had a blind infant in any of this population, which is different than some of the Japanese litter of 22% blindness in one recent paper in 2023. And our use of intervention, whether it's VEGF or laser, was only 9% at 22 weeks and 3% at 23 weeks.
Wow.
So, and to me, ROP protection is very important for neurodevelopmental outcome, minimizing blindness or significant visual loss. So now we did publish a paper. Obviously, it's small numbers and it's single center, but single center is important because management strategies tremendously impact your neurodevelopmental outcomes. So if you use a large database of many different hospitals, there's huge differences in management. And management directly impacts cerebral blood flow, which then directly impacts neurologic outcome. And you basically regress to the mean. If you look at specific center and look at their management strategies, such as Iowa, our neurodevelopment outcome, which was published in 2020 in Journal of Pediatrics, looked at 22 and 23 weekers. And in those 45, 22 and 23 weekers that were able to get corrected age 18 to 22 months adjusted for gestation, the severe neurodevelopment impairment rate was only 11%, which is incredibly low. Most people think it's going to be 50% severe. Yeah. And a very great article written by Genevieve Taylor, published in Pediatrics a few years ago, looked at developmental testing at age 2 and then looked again at age 10. And it was this is a paper that should get lots of reading because she showed that 67% of severe and even profound, which I wasn't even thinking about, shifted, 67% went to normal mild, which was shocking. So mm-hmm. I get very emotionally upset when I hear people trying to use two-year data to decide whether you're going to offer resuscitation.
Yeah. That was very eye-opening.
And so there are places that will use things on the internet. We're part of the Neonatal Research Network, and that was never designed, was designed for research and understanding, but it wasn't designed to make hardcore decisions on individualized basis because it's population-based data. And the danger is applying a population outcome to a single individual when all individuals are on bell-shaped curves and you can't predict with 100% certainty unless you have a lot more data, which you don't have at that beginning. So I find it very upsetting when they're using that to whether they even offer resuscitation without even seeing how this patient's going to do.
One of the things that we're doing with TIPQC with this Tiniest Babies project, we are in the process of actually tackling severe IVH right now. And so what you have just talked about, we've got a toolkit we've shared with all the level 3 and 4 NICUs in the state. Hopefully there will be some changes in practice and some similarities in practice based on what our experts have recommended. And now we're in the midst of trying to tackle this chronic lung disease problem, which, as we talked about before, is actually increasing because we're doing a better job of taking care of these tiny babies. So let us in on some of your secrets of care, what the Iowa NICU does. I mean, not only to try to help prevent chronic lung disease, but just all the really important things that you do. What's your secrets for success? What's your recipe here?
So I'm going to back up a little bit, because it's really important when you brought up severe IVH to realize, again, is the choice of severe IVH, do we increase the risk of severe IVH, or do we increase the risk of BPD? Now, these are not equivalent, but unfortunately, people treat them as equivalent. And so a baby with grade 3 or grade 4 IVH is very different from a baby who's going home on a half liter nasal cannula oxygen, no IVH, no PVL, no ROP, no NEC, at the exact percentile they were born with for growth and head circumference and length, breastfeeding at lib with a supplemental bottle or two, and going home at their due date. And that's considered, that being on oxygen for a few months, the same level as a grade 4 IVH taking out a hemisphere of your brain. This is a huge problem. And so people need to, you can't get both. Unfortunately, in life, you have to make trade-offs and you have to use what is more important. And I think it's sort of obvious. Now, the other thing is, when we're talking about BPD, is that I really think people need to switch the 21st century definition of BPD, which is a brilliant work published in 2019 by Eric Jensen out of CHOP. And this is, again, another seminal paper that everyone should read and understand.
And yeah, we're using this definition too, by the way, in our toolkits.
But the important point is two things. One is grade 3A, which he doesn't talk much about, but that was talked about by Alan Jobe in the 2018 workshop, which is death from respiratory failure before you even make the 36 weeks post-menstrual age. And if you pass away, then you won't have BPD. And in many places that talk about a low rate of BPD tend to have very low survival at 22 and 23 weeks. And so one is, you have to be alive. Now, why is this such a major issue? If you look at a paper published by Sunny Jewell from the PINA trial, where they tried to use erythropoietin as neuroprotection, which unfortunately failed, there was a follow-up paper that looked at the cause of mortality in 24 to 25, 26, 27 week babies. And the leading cause of mortality for 24 and 25 weekers was respiratory failure. So I find that quite shocking that respiratory failure is the leading cause of death. So I feel people need a better approach. If I look at just our 22 weekers, respiratory failure is only responsible for the death of 8% of that population. So one of the things is, we have to focus on not having these babies die at a high rate from respiratory failure. But also, we want to be protecting the brain in the first 2 weeks. So in order to protect the brain in the first 2 weeks of life for 22 to 23 and even 24 weekers, is not to allow them to have trial of extubation in the first 2 weeks of life, because the consequence of failing is catastrophic, which is a fourfold increase in mortality and significant increases in IVH, sepsis, NEC, and even BPD, because as you fail, you get out electrotrauma. And that's been also replicated again in a paper from the APEX cohort, where there were no 22 weekers, but they had 100% failure rate in the first 8 days of life in 23 weekers by extubating them. And then when they looked at the mortality causes, IVH was there, pulmonary hemorrhage was there, NEC was there, all things related by ischemia. So one of the things is, you have to think about, these are two different populations. The 22 to 25 weekers, you should be thinking on the 21st century definition. Hey, let's have them live and let's make sure, can we avoid being still stuck on the ventilator at 36 weeks post-menstrual age? Because that's what correlates with a twofold increase in severe NDI. If we're talking about the older population, 27 to 32 weeks, the 1980s definition of oxygen at 36 weeks is a good definition. I mean, that was come up in the 60s and 70s. So we should be able to really minimize the need for oxygen at discharge, at 36 weeks PMA for that population of the 20th century, 27 weeks and older. And in the population kind of 26 weeks and less, we need not to have them die of respiratory failure. And we need to have hopefully almost all of them, the vast majority, off the ventilator by 36 weeks PMA. Invariably, when you talk about 22 and 23 weekers, and if you look at the data uniformly from high survival centers from Sweden, let's say Japan, Iowa, invariably close to 100% of those babies are on some supplemental oxygen at 36 weeks. That oxygen is helping them grow. Sometimes it's minimizing chronic pulmonary hypertension. Sometimes you're using it to suppress ROP. A lot of times it's helping to reduce the work of breathing so that we can focus on transitioning to oral feeds. It is interesting that when you use Eric Jensen's work, which is well validated, grade 2 BPD is you just on CPAP. So there are centers that I feel game the whole thing, that they keep babies on CPAP, whether they need to or not. So at 36 weeks, they can be on 21% oxygen and say they're not on oxygen, just atmospheric, so they don't have BPD, even though they're using mechanical device to distend the lung, which is good because, I mean, it's good to have good VQ matching. But using a certain definition, that's counted as zero BPD. And if you use NIH definition, it would be considered severe BPD. And if you use Eric Jensen's, it's grade 2. Now, so I think we should all focus on minimizing grade 3A death, minimizing grade 3 still stuck on the ventilator, and importantly, minimizing neurologic injury from failing extubation in the first few weeks of life. This is very different than we do know. Yeah, if you can avoid the ventilator, that's great. But if we look at the 22 and 23 week population, there's a great paper out of the University of Alabama that showed trying to avoid pseudo-elective intubation in the delivery room and try to avoid intubating them and see if you can avoid that, because let's say if we can avoid the tube, it's great. Unfortunately, for 22 and 23 weekers, it doubles mortality and what we're talking about, severe IVH. So you have to treat this as a different population. I have no problem. Oh, 25, 26 weeker, looks like they're doing well. Okay, let's try non-invasive ventilation. 22 and 23 weeks, they go on the vent. Most places at 22 weeks, Sweden and Japan, one place is different, Cologne, Germany, but Iowa, electively intubating them within 30 seconds of birth so that they're not getting hypoxic, hypercarbic, and getting them to transition. So it's important right from the very beginning, based on that work out of Alabama, which replicates our experience, and I think is responsible for higher survival and low IVH rate. And I think it's very hard to ask the 22-weeker, when you're at the canalicular stage, to have the same oxygen need at 36 weeks as someone born at 27 weeks. It's just, and that has been showing more and more in the literature, and even the APEX trial, we're showing that, they're very focused on minimizing BPD. That was the whole point of that 5 academic center cohort. But they find that the very premature babies, it's not linear. There's kind of a threshold. And I find the same thing in the literature, that just sort of under 26 weeks-ish, that this 22 to 25 weekers, you can't expect them to 100% be off oxygen, all of them. And most of them, as you eventually drop down to 22, almost all of them will be on some oxygen at 36 weeks. But the goal should be, one, not to have them die from respiratory failure. Two, have them not suffer severe IVH. Three, get them growing well enough so we can have them extubated prior to 36 weeks PMA.
Yeah, so if we look at your recipe from what you've given me so far, I'm hearing for this population, intubate them immediately in the delivery room. And then the next important thing is no trial of extubation for the first 2 weeks, which is really interesting because I think like last week I saw on Twitter or X or whatever we're supposed to call it now.
That survey.
Yeah, the survey, and goodness, what was it, like 30 or 40% of people said they would extubate within the first 1 to 3 days of life? I think a 450 gram 22 weeker?
Yeah, it was a theoretical patient. The correct response was only 10%, which is obviously my people responding.
Me too.
And, and
I was shocked. I was like, wow, this is.
But it explains, to me, it explains why, if you look at what is the survival of 22-weekers mm-hmm. in U.S. VON networks, it's 30 to 40, it's, well, 27%. And so this is why the leading cause of mortality at 24 weeks, 60% of the deaths are due to respiratory failure. I would say, therefore, at 22 weeks, based on some of the data, speculating is about 70% of the deaths. And that's because they're extubating these patients too early. And not understanding the consequences of failure and pushing very aggressively with the idea that, well, if we can get them off the ventilator sooner, they'll have less BPD. Well, that I'm not going to dispute that, but they're going to have consequences such as severe IVH, NEC, and a fourfold increase in mortality.
I loved how you framed this for everybody that's listening. And it's exactly what TIPQC has done. I mean, we're dealing with the severe IVH first, and we're seeing a decrease in our IV rate amongst our 12 NICUs that are participating in this so far. And now let's see if we can make some improvements in BPD. So give me some more of your recipe. What else do you do at Iowa that we can learn from to help improve everything?
I would say the next unique thing is, again, in this population, we'll say kind of 22 to 24 weeks, they're very susceptible to volume trauma. And that has to be a priority to prevent this mechanical injury. And the interesting thing is that actually has to start in the delivery room. There was a great trial published called the SAIL trial, and it had to be stopped early. And what they, based on older babies, or sorry, more mature babies, they thought if you did a sustained inflation, get that lung open, you'll have better outcomes, you know, in terms of chronic lung disease. And what happened instead, there was a 500% increase in mortality in the babies under 26 weeks, kind of the, there were no 22 weekers, but the 23 to 25 weekers. Because the problem is when you do this sustained inflation to a lung that's primarily respiratory bronchioles, you end up causing a lot of injury. And so when you push, when you don't balance oxidative and mechanical injury and you go extreme one direction or the other, you're going to have complications. And luckily, they stopped that trial early because people, you know, the brilliance of many of these great researchers doing these very complex randomized controlled trials is sometimes having negative results keeps us from doing something wrong and making an assumption. So I thought that was really important information. And so one of the first things is that, and we also even know from the COIN trial, which was trying to avoid intubation with nasal CPAP, they showed at 8 centimeters, they had a threefold increase in pneumothorax versus 5 or 6, actually 6. So putting all this together, our initial approach is to avoid hyperinflation, which I consider very neuroprotective, because if you get hyperinflated, you don't have any preload, your right atrium's collapsed. So you have inadequate blood flow to the lungs, inadequate blood in the left atrium, inadequate left ventricle, poor cardiac output, ischemic brain injury. So it's, to me, it's neuroprotective to avoid hyperinflation. And I again feel that the problem is surfactant deficiency initially rather than PEEP deficiency. So we would rather come back on PEEP of 5, be on 70% or 100% oxygen briefly, get the x-rays, get the surfactant in, and then try to get down to 30-40% or less.
So we have so much fantastic material today with Dr. Klein. We're going to have to cut this into two different podcasts. So tune in next week for the second episode where we'll continue learning all about Iowa's recipe and how we can apply this to Tennessee's tiniest babies.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, presented by TIPQC. TIPQC is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health. Do you have ideas for a future guest or topic, or even have a question you would like answered on upcoming episodes? Visit www.tipqc.org, that's T-I-P-Q-C.org, and click on podcast to submit suggestions and questions to our podcast team. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast to be the first to know when new episodes are available, and find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube to stay in the loop with our active projects and other relevant news relating to perinatal health in Tennessee.